Now, our friend Ruth, she was working with the UN, and it's a huge problem in Cambodia, particularly Phnom Penh, that families actually sell their daughters into these terrible places. And she was on this raid and rescue team, and her job was to care for these girls and try and sort of keep them on the right road. But it was such a dispiriting work, because they go, they'd raid the place, they close it down. A few weeks later it was running again, and the girls would go back to it. It seemed to have some kind of hold. And she was paid a lot of money to do this. She was very well qualified, and she sought the Lord and said, "What should I do?" And it wasn't a voice out the sky, but as she prayed, the Lord guided her, and the Lord showed her that she actually needed to get a little car that she drove around. And driving around Phnom Penh isn't exactly the safest thing in the world to do. It's like a cowboy town, if you've ever been there. To drive her car around, go to these places, and actually come in and say, "Any girls want to come out, follow me." And she didn't know what to do from that point on. Just knew God wanted her to do that. And she had this car full of these girls, went back to her house, gave them counselling and started to help them learn little trades. Said she was doing it because she loved Jesus. And now, about 10 years on, she's running this wonderful work called Daughters. And you can Google it, daughtersofcambodia.org. It's a fantastic work. And hundreds of girls have come through this. And they've been taught trades. There's kind of little industries, little cottage industries they run. They've been set on the right road, living new lives, and many of those girls have come to know Jesus. And it was just so wonderful going to the cafe that they run, and some of the girls who work in that cafe have been rescued from that place, and to see how their lives have been changed. And most of those girls knew Jesus. It really gave me a bit of cred, actually, when I was in the cafe. Lots of Australians come. It's really good food there, and they were saying, "Wow, you know, isn't this great? This girl is really good." And I said, "I knew her when she was a young person, you know." And they said, "Wow, I was like a star myself, you know." But it's fantastic. Someone who made a difference. Now, Hugh was praying about the kind of situation that we're in, and we look at the Middle East, we look at our own country, we look at our own workplace, and we think, how can I make a difference? Well, we can. Not because of our own strength, but because we've got God with us. And he uses each one and each of us to work his plan, to work according to his purposes. And we can see that through the example of Gideon. Now let's look at Gideon and think about how we make a difference. What do we do? Well, firstly, we need to face the issues. And the people of Israel had some huge issues that needed to be faced up to. An old adversary, the Midianites, who had originally been defeated in Moses' time, had regrouped and were stronger than ever and had become quite formidable. And it's described in verse 2. Because the power of Midian was so oppressive, the Israelites prepared shelters for themselves in mountain clefts, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites, Amalekites, and other eastern people invaded the country. They camped on the land and ruined the crops all the way to Gaza, and did not spare a living thing for Israel, neither sheep, nor cattle, nor donkeys. They come up with their livestock and their tents like swarms of locusts. It was impossible to count the men and their camels. They invaded the land to ravage it. Now, this was actually a very sophisticated form of terrorism. Instead of invading Israel, they'd let them get on with life as normal. Sowing the seeds, attending their crops, maintaining their livestock, raising their families. And just at the crucial time, when the crops were ripe, when the livestock was strong, they put the boot in. Unleashing raiding parties, stealing everything that had been grown, killing off the livestock, demolishing their homes and driving them into the mountains. And we're also told they forged a couple of pretty deadly alliances. One with the Amalekites, who were a nomadic tribe. And they first attacked Israel when they initially left Egypt. You can read about that in Exodus 17. And then what's described as the people from the east. And that's just a general description of an alliance of tribes that were against Israel. This one little country being attacked by all around. But there was an underlying reason. There was an issue that needed to be faced. And we read about it in verse 1. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and for 7 years he gave them into the hands of the Midianites. Now, if you know the book of Judges, you'll know it's really a series of seven cycles, some people call them. I call them ever-decreasing circles because they seem to get worse every time. The people go away from God. They worship idols. And so God judges them. He gives them over to their sin. He withdraws his protection. He sends their enemies. And for a while they suffer in ignorance. Then they call out to God. He answers their prayer. He sends a judge, a deliverer who rescues them. For a time they carry on worshipping the Lord and living for him, but then the judge dies and they slip into old ways and that circle starts again and it gets worse and worse and worse. And here, in this cycle, in this ever-decreasing circle, after 7 long years of fear, attack and destruction, they finally call out to the Lord in their desperation. And in response, he sends them a prophet. So it's incredible, isn't it? You know, we're in need, Lord. Do something. What does he do? He sends a prophet. You know, it's like when you come to someone and you say, help me, please. And what do? They open a Bible. You know, you think, what helps a Bible to me? Well, it's got God's word in it. It's going to help me face the issue. Look at what happens here. They were challenged to face up to what lay at the root of all this. God spoke to them about their commitment and his commitment to them, the covenant that he had with them. Verse 8, he sent a prophet who said, this is what the Lord God of Israel says. I brought you up out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of all your oppressors. I drove them from before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live. But you have not listened to me. Have you noticed that? I brought you up. I snatched you from Egypt. I drove them from before you. I said to you, I am the Lord, your God. God had committed himself to them. That's what the covenant was. God's commitment to his people. And they were to respond by committing themselves to him. It was initiated by God. And if you read about that covenant, that agreement that God made with them in the Old Testament, you will see there were conditions. Way back in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 28, verse 29, God said, if they stray from him and worship idols, they will be unsuccessful in everything they do. Day after day, they will be oppressed and robbed with no one to rescue them. Now, that's not exactly what they wanted to hear. It's like when you take your car in and there's a kind of funny noise on the wheel. And you take your car in to be repaired. And the guy says, in Derbyshire, you know, they like to really kind of lay it on. He says, oh, I don't know about that, you know, duck. They'll say duck there. You haven't been driving this car right, has thou? And you don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that you've knocked the thing and you've broken it and it's your fault and it's going to cost hundreds of pounds to repair. But you've got to face up to it. You know, to make a difference, we've got to come before God and say, Lord, what is it that needs to be changed in my life for me to make a difference? You know, for our friend Ruth, it was she had to be obedient. She had to step out of that very secure situation in faith and do what the Lord wanted her to do. And we all have to face up to that, to get before God with an open Bible. You know, like David says in Psalm 139, search me, O God, and see if there be any wicked way in me. Show me the ways I need to grow, the areas in my life I need to adjust, the challenges that I face. You know, and God will tell us, God will speak, you know, as we look at his word and as we listen to him. So how do we make a difference? Firstly, we've got to face the issues in our life before God so we're right with him and we're sharpened tools. And then secondly, we've got to depend on God's strength. It's not about us, it's about God. Gideon was an ordinary man from an inconsequential family who lived in a place called Ophrah, which was near the Midianite border. So he would have borne the brunt of the attack. And if you've ever been near a border, you know how vulnerable you are. I only know this kind of retrospectively, but a few years ago I was in Kenya And the guy we stayed with took us to the Lamu province to do some Bible teaching. And it was quite exciting. We went over the river in a speedboat. And, you know, someone followed me at night, someone from the church, to make sure I was protected. And it was just a few miles from the border of Somalia. And it was kind of exciting until I read about kidnappings and awful things that were going on. And there was cholera just over the border. Then suddenly you realize how vulnerable you are living so near there. And, you know, those Christians who live so near there, well, they were in that position where churches will get burnt down and people will be forced to return to Islam because they were so near the militant Islam in Somalia there. And Gideon's in that kind of situation. And when we find him, we see this almost comical scene here. He's threshing wheat in a wine press. I mean, a wine press is pretty small. You thresh wheat on the floor of a barn, but obviously there was so little of it, all he could do was thresh it in a wine press. And of course, plus, you could be hidden when you're doing that. It's a really sad scene. It just reeks of defeat and sadness and despair. I mean, it's kind of like being in the dressing room of the England team at their last game of the World Cup, you know? But before we actually meet him and hear from him, someone else comes on the scene. Verse 11. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in the winepress to keep it from the Midianites. Now, angel of the Lord here is actually the Lord himself. It's a visible presence of God. The technical word is a theophany. A visible presence of God. This is God speaking to him. And Gideon doesn't realize who it is. As far as he's concerned, it's a man. It's a man who's watching him. Although there's no doubting he's taken aback by the greeting. The Lord is with you, mighty warrior. Mighty warrior. Here's this little man. Well, I presume he was, well, he might not have been little, but here's this kind of insignificant person in a wine press threshing wheat, hiding from the enemy. And this guy says to him, mighty warrior. When I studied theology, well, for the first time, I've just studied again recently. I've just done a master's. But when I did was an undergraduate, we used to have an Egyptian lecturer. And he used to say to me, how's a great theologian? And I always used to think it was a bit sarcastic when I saw the marks he gave me for my essay. You know, how's the great theologian? You know, I think, well, you know, do you really mean what you say there? Tiny bit of sarcasm in there. Mighty warrior. Is that sarcasm? No, not from God. God's addressing him in terms of what he was going to become. That's how he saw him. Not this man in a wine press in defeat and despair, but a victorious soldier in his army. A mighty warrior. Now, Gideon doesn't quite see it this way. And remember, he doesn't know it's the Lord, but he sees there's something special about this visitor. Verse 13. But sir, Gideon replied, if the Lord is with us, why has all this happened to us? Where are all the wonders our fathers told us about when they said, did not the Lord bring us up out of Egypt? But now the Lord has abandoned us and put us into the hand of Midian. Remember, Gideon and his people have endured 7 years of terrorism. He's held on to the faith of his fathers, but his father hasn't. We'll find out that later. He's not forsaken the Lord, and he's wrestling with heartfelt issues. You know, it's okay to struggle with issues. It's okay to wrestle with what's going on in your life. You look through the Psalms and you see how David, you know, wrestles through those things. Where are you, Lord? Job and others and Jeremiah. But God's response to Gideon doesn't even attempt to answer those questions. He just tells Gideon he's part of that solution, the solution. Verse 14. The Lord turned to him and said, go in the strength you have and save Israel out of Midian's hand. Am I not sending you? Strength in weakness. I mean, that's a principle we see throughout the Bible and that Paul speaks about in the New Testament. When I'm weak, then I'm strong. Strength in God doesn't come from a big personality or a great intellect. It comes through sheer dependence on God, leaning on him. It's a lovely story I heard once of a guy who'd had a big cancer operation, had half a, one and a half sort of a lung of his lung taken. There wasn't much of it left. So he could hardly breathe, hardly speak, but he loved to sing. And he was in a church choir and the choir master said, look, come to the choir. He said, I can't sing. what do you expect me to do? He said, come on, you'll see. And this choir master was a great big guy, and a bit like Hugh before he lost all that weight. Great big guy. And he said, right, okay, stand there. And the guy stood just in front of him there. He said, right, when we start the song, lean back on me. And he leant back on me, and this guy bellowed out from his great kind of Pavarotti chest. And he gave this man that kind of power and strength so that he could sing. Strength in weakness. That's what God gives us. But it still doesn't satisfy Gideon. Still has more questions. just full of them. Verse 15, but Lord, Gideon asked, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I'm the least in my family. You couldn't get much lower than that. You're like kind of the worst player on the English team, aren't you? You're at the end of it. But the Lord answered, verse 16, I will be with you, and you will strike down the Midianites together. That's the same promise he gave to Moses. God said, I will be with you. And to Joshua, no one shall stand up against you all the days of your life. Joshua 1 verse 5, as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. Isaiah 41 verse 10. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my victorious right hand. And to us, the last words that Jesus spoke before he ascended to heaven, what were they? Surely I am with you to the end of the age. You may not have a detailed explanation about what's happening in your life. You may not be given answers to all the questions. And sometimes, we just have to, say, Lord, I relinquish my desire to know exactly what's happening. I'm not going to find out. Not this side of eternity. I'm not going to waste any more energy, but I'm going to draw strength from you and go the way you call me to. You may not have an instant solution for your problems, but you have this promise. I am with you. Go in God's strength. And you'll make a difference. So we've got to face the issue, depend on God's strength, and then we've got to fear the Lord. That's the third area. Now, I'm not using fear in a negative way. I'm talking about healthy fear, a fear of God, the fear that's spoken about in the Bible. I can see out there in the congregation, we've got someone who's involved with Oak Hall. And have you done skiing trips? Yeah? Great, aren't they? Hope you've got recruited lots of people to come. Yeah, great. Go to Oak. I'm doing one tomorrow, Tuesday. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm going down a rabbit hole there. I love speaking on these Oak Hall trips, and we go with parties, and we do skiing in the summer, and sorry, no, we don't. Skiing in the Dutch mountains in the summer. No, we go skiing in the winter and summer stuff. What you have to do when you're skiing is to get people, especially beginners, to have a healthy fear of the mountains. Because when people first start skiing, they're nervous. Then they get a bit confident, they get a bit cocky, and they start doing silly things. And you have to say, look, you've got to have a respect for that mountain. It's not going to bend to what you want. You've got to treat it the right way. Fear of God. We've got to have that healthy reverence for God. He's God. And to do his will, a desire to do his will. Now, that's what Gideon has. Now, he realizes there's something very special about his visitor. He calls him Lord. But he wants to be sure that the promise is from God. I mean, he realizes this is a messenger from God. He doesn't realize it's God himself. So we read in verse 17, if I've now found favor in your eyes, give me a sign that it's really you talking to me. Now, in that culture, it was customary to give an honoured guest a meal. And when they accepted your invitation, that was a sign of their favour. And that would have been on Gideon's mind when he gave this invitation. So he toddles off, prepares the food, presents it to his guest, and then he's given an order, which he duly obeys. Verse 20, the angel of the Lord said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread, place them on the rock and pour out the broth. And Gideon did so. With the tip of his staff that was in his right hand, the angel of the Lord touched the meat and the unleavened bread. Fire flared from the rock, consuming the meat and the bread. And the angel of the Lord disappeared. And that is really significant. When the Lord touched the food, it was consumed. That goes right back to the offerings in Leviticus. It was a sign that a sacrifice had been accepted. Not what Gideon was expecting. It was a sign of God's favor that he could never have hoped for. And then the angel of the Lord disappeared. And he'd realized he'd encountered the living God. The living God had been with him. And all his questions are gone. He exclaimed, verse 22, "Ah, sovereign Lord, I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face." The Hebrew word is an expression of terror. Gideon is petrified. He's seen God and he's afraid he'll die. But the Lord gives him the assurance that he won't. Verse 23, the Lord said to him, "Peace. Don't be afraid. You are not going to die." So the Lord built an altar there and called it, "The Lord is Peace." To that day it stands in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Now, was this kind of fear uncalled for? I mean, he had God's strength, he had God's promise. I don't think so. Not if you compare it with a whole load of people in the Bible who have that same experience, right through the old and new. Isaiah. Peter said, "Depart from me, Lord, I'm a sinful man." John said that he fell at his feet as though dead. Surely it was this healthy fear of God that gave him the courage to make the stand that he goes on to make. We've got to have that fear of the Lord, the desire to honour him above all else, because he's God and he's the one we're accountable to. So how do we make a difference? Well, we need to face the issue, depend on God's strength, fear the Lord, and then, this is where the rubber hits the road, make a stand. Now God told him what to do. He commanded him to dismantle the altar of Baal and replace it with an altar that sacrifices to the true and living God. Verse 23, that same night the Lord said to him, "Take the second bull from your father's herd, the one 7 years old. Tear down your father's altar to the Baal and cut down the Asherah pole beside it. Then build a proper kind of altar to the Lord your God on top of this height. Using the wood, the Asherah pole that you cut down, offer the second bull as a burnt offering." Now this time Gideon didn't debate, discuss or question. He just got on with the job. Now, I know it says that he got on with it at night because of fear of his family, but I think this was actually, you know, the right kind of fear. This was actually, you know, being sharp and pragmatic, because, you know, he wouldn't have been able to do it in the day. They'd have lynched him before he started. And imagine the scene the next morning when everyone goes around their business. There's no shrine to the goddess of nature anymore. No focus for the community's worship of Baal. There's a new altar, an altar to the living God, the God they'd left behind. And it didn't seem to take long for them to work out who did it, because clearly Gideon still served and loved the Lord. "Who did this?" they asked. "Gideon, son of Jerubbaal." "Son of Joash." And they demanded, "Joash, bring out your son, he must die, because the Lord has broken down Baal's altar and cut down the Asherah pole beside it." Now, I think if I was in Gideon's sandals at this moment, I'd have thought, "What have I done?" You know, that friend of ours that I was telling you about, Ruth, I must ask, what was it like when she first had those girls who crammed into the car in her house thinking, "Okay, Lord, what do I do now? You know, where do I go to now?" God doesn't always give us everything at once. Sometimes it's a bit like a sat-nav, isn't it? You know, we just have to follow it bit by bit, step by step. "What now, Lord? What's going to happen? What's the next step?" And he has a defense from the most unlikely source, from the patron of the shrine, happens to be his father. Look at verse 31. Joash replied to the hostile crowds around him. "Remember, they're about to lynch him. It's really dangerous. Are you going to plead Baal's cause? Are you trying to save him? Whoever fights for him shall be put to death by morning. If Baal really is a god, he can defend himself when someone breaks down the altar." Now, you could say this was a father's loyalty to his son. But I think that there's more to this. There's a logic. He's suddenly come to his right mind. He suddenly says, "Well, look, this idol can't protect itself. It can't be a god, can it?" Not only does Gideon make his father renounce his godless religion, he gets the respect of his hometown and they start to gather around him. He makes a difference and he goes on to lead them into victory. You know, you never know what one solitary act of obedience can do. to make a stand and say, no, I'm not going to do that. Whatever the consequence, I am not going to do that, and how God will use it. You never know in your life, maybe there's something going on and you know it's wrong, something going wrong at work or at college or whatever, and you've got to say, look, this just isn't right. And you make that stand and you see what God will do, how God will use it. It was Leslie Newbegin who said, the real triumph of the gospel has not been won when the church is strong in a worldly sense. They've been won when the church is faithful in the midst of weakness, contempt and rejection. Kind of sums up where we are now, doesn't it? But we belong to God's kingdom. We're called to spread his light. We can dispel that darkness because God says, I am with you. Let's make a difference out there.